you know, I spent a lot of time with Hardy DeSoto, God rest his soul, my roommate from college, and just eating some good homemade cheese in an arepa on the mountainside in Venezuela, and climbing on a truck that had probably 5,000 overripe mangoes leaking on the street, and you're eating a mango and you're wearing it, and you're really getting into the jungle and wondering, my God, this experience, someday will I be able to share that with my customers? And now you and I were talking about how you zoom into this farm where something's growing, and it's all happening now. All that knowledge, all that information of the source, you know, people don't appreciate that everything comes from a farm or from the ocean or from a field, and how it ends up in your plate.
The bison, 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 the bison.
Hello, Bison, and welcome back to this Nichols College Alumni Experience Podcast. You're in for a real treat today if you're a foodie, home chef, or cooking show enthusiast. Today's guest is Henry Wehner, who graduated from Nichols in 1972 and is owner and president of his family's fourth generation company, Sid Wehner & Son, which was founded in 1914. If you've watched an episode of Chopped on the Food Network, chances are the ingredients you see in the pantry were sourced by Henry and his company. The Boston Herald once referred to him as the Willy Wonka of produce. From five-star hotels to first-class airplane cabins to the personal tables of celebrities like Frank Sinatra, who loved his artichokes, and Jimmy Buffett, over the years, Henry's company has become known as one of the world's leading and most innovative food suppliers. Today, I join Henry from Sid Wehner & Son's new 65,000-square-foot facility in New Bedford, Massachusetts, where each Saturday you can taste test their amazing products. As a former mayor of the Hill, and we'll get into exactly what that means, welcome to the podcast, Henry.
Thank you very much.
So before we start talking about your business, let me start off by asking you, how did you wind up at Nichols College?
I was looking for a school I could go to, which was small enough so I could focus on my studies. And when I first visited Nichols, I went and stayed with some friends for a weekend, and I just loved the environment. I loved the fact that it was small. Back then, it was business and forestry. I met some great guys, and I was looking for an education and a great time, and I found both.
Awesome. Now, many alumni who are listening might recognize the title of Mayor of the Hill. However, that's a tradition for whatever reason that hasn't continued at Nichols. So for our younger alumni, can you explain a little bit about what a Mayor of the Hill did and how does one get to be elected as Mayor of the Hill?
Well, back then, you were either president of the student body, the student association, or the mayor. I was involved in the whole social life of Nichols, and I ran the bar. Mm-hmm. And I was actually running the bar, and I wasn't old enough to sign the check. So that was pretty good because it was just that transformational year where you had to be 21 to drink and you got in at 20. And it was just really, it was a great opportunity to represent my fellow students. Back then, I was hiring most of the bands that were going up to UMass on the weekend. So we had Kenny Rogers. We had Jonathan Edwards. We had Sha Na Na. I think we had John Sebastian. We pulled a lot of shenanigans to get these people there on a Friday. Had to kind of throw a party for them to get them to stop on their way to UMass.
Well, that must have been fun time. So you weren't here for the big Aerosmith debut?
No, that one nope. I missed. No, nope, that one I missed. But we had a good time. And you know, back then it was 600 guys. When I went in, we had to wear a tie and jacket to dinner every night. And there was no fraternities, but it was like your dorm was your fraternity. And your dorm people became your best friends. And the people that I live in the dorm still are my best friends.
And they called it the Underhill Gang for a reason.
Yeah, right. Area. Exactly. We're Underhill, Bill. We're always playing against Budley.
There's been a lot of talk generationally about things moving very fast from a technology and a social standpoint. Even students who graduate decades apart have such different experiences that it becomes hard for them to relate to people outside their age group. You graduated at such a unique time, I think, at Nichols' history, but also the country's history. There was the Vietnam War, the hippie movement. Some could argue the best music that was ever made was made then. And from a technology standpoint, it was a lot of simpler of a time. What was it like attending Nichols College in the late 60s and early 70s?
Well, I'll never forget. We were in Underhill. I think I was a sophomore or a junior when we had the draft. And I remember we got a barrel and some moonshine and we mixed up a pretty good brew that night. But it was a pretty scary event. You know, my brother-in-law and some older friends were there off to Vietnam and the war was on. So you didn't want to drop out of school or get thrown out of school. And it was a pretty scary time. And that was when computers weren't as prevalent as they are now. I mean, right now we're in a world where, you know, if you want to find a recipe, you put up chicken cacciatore and get it 1,000 different ways. Back then, you know, you had to really dig in. You had to spend more time in the library and you couldn't go on Google and figure out what you wanted to do. And actually back then, if you wanted to talk to a friend, you'd pick up the phone and call them. You wouldn't be texting them or emailing them. So there's just so much information available and how the times have changed since then. And, you know, I think about 9/11. I remember that we fed the firemen from New Bedford through the James Beard House because we supplied the James Beard House back then. So you just flashed me to that. I just showed you a flag I hung up outside my office that day. It's still there. So that was a pretty astounding time. It was very serious. The American cuisine has changed so drastically, especially with all the information that's available online that you can access. So it makes a big difference.
Talking about your family business a bit, Sid Wehner and Son, I know you'll have 105 years to cover in a short amount of time, but can you kind of run us through a brief history of the company?
Sure. My grandfather started the company in 1914 on the historic streets in New Bedford, Massachusetts. And back then, he was selling the push cots. The whaling industry had just come to an end. New Bedford was the whaling capital of the world. And people were living like they live in the old country now in Europe still. You know, it was the corner store. Families would go there. They'd shop all week. They'd have an account on a book underneath the register. On Friday night, they'd get the paycheck. They'd go pay for their food first, and then they'd take whatever was left, pay their electric. And New Bedford was made up of a lot of three tenement houses. So a lot of people came over from Europe. They'd take the three tenements. They'd move seven families. And the next thing you know, they'd own all seven houses on the block because they worked hard. And, you know, New Bedford being fishing and textiles, being a large Portuguese population, it attracted them here, which was pretty good because they were a really good workforce to work with. I've been working with them my whole life.
Can you explain all the different jobs that you had at the company before you took over as president? And the reason I ask is a lot of our Nichols students will probably one day take over a family business.
Well, after my grandfather, my dad got out of the war in 1946, and he reestablished Sid Wehner & Son Wholesale Produce Company, opened a small variety store in the south end of New Bedford. I joined him when I could walk, because my dad worked around the clock. His normal day was 17 hours. So I grew up driving a truck, going to the market for 20 years, buying the produce at 3 a.m. and coming back, selling it, sometimes going back for another load, coming back and selling it. And then things started to evolve. I opened up the vineyard, and then we opened up Newport, Rhode Island, and I started to live with chefs. And I started to learn what they were learning in other parts of the country that they were cooking with in the off season. I knew that out there were the ingredients they were looking for. So I went out and I found them. Simultaneously, food safety became an important factor in our industry. We're the first HACCP certified produce company, which is the food safety program that they wrote for astronauts in NASA. And we've been the leader in food industry all of my life since I've taken over the company. My dad was amazing when, you know, he never stood in my way. He said, let's do what you want to do. And I've been an advocate of, and I've taught my key people that work for me, that if you make it your fault, and this only not only goes for business, but it goes in for your life. If you make it your fault, you'll fix it. As soon as you blame the other guy, you got a million excuses and you never take the responsibility to get it done. And all my kids learned that at a very young age. You know, I was driven, I was motivated, and I was driven to succeed. I always found out what a chef wanted next, and I went out in the world and I found it. Got married to my wife, Marion, 36 years ago. We went to Europe on our honeymoon. I had never been there before. Everybody went to the museums, and I went to the street markets. And then I followed the street markets to the guys in the market to their favorite restaurants. And then those restaurants took me to their favorite suppliers. And around the world we went to source just the most amazing ingredients with the story and the history and their families. I always took my children, and this is something that somebody should learn from. I always made it a family affair. If we went to Italy, the whole family went to Italy. And my daughter just went to Japan and went through what I went through like 20-something years ago with my supplier's son, you know, the Sashimi Master's restaurant and an official tea. And it's a cyclical thing. History always comes back to repeat itself. You know, I can tell you for those students who are looking forward to business, you're going to make a million decisions, and you can't make too many bad ones. So you got to go with your instincts. You got to trust your instincts. You have to be passionate about what you want to do, because it's the passion that motivates and drives you in the right direction.
In college, case studies are pretty easy compared to a lot of those real world decisions business leaders have to make. Was there a particular decision that you were forced to make in order to keep things on track that might have kept you up, you know, some sleepless night?
Well, I can think of a thousand things, because, you know, originally when we opened up the market, I opened a meet in Delhi with it, and we put in all this new equipment, and all of a sudden the bank decided that they didn't want to support me on that. That was a very scary time. I don't know. I just took everything as a challenge to me. It was like, if I work really hard and I'm really smart and I figure out a way and I don't take no for an answer and I make everything my fault and I'm going to find the best solution, and the best solution will always work out. That's what I did. I never let people get in my way to do it, and it wasn't easy, you know. It's never easy to hire and fire people, and it's never easy to build the team that you need, but the team that you need is exactly what you need in order to move forward. You can't do it all yourself. And, you know, when I took over, we had 17 employees, and now we're at 800.
Now, you mentioned change, and, you know, in this day of internet commerce, things are changing from a retail standpoint overnight. I read a lot about Amazon's acquisition of Whole Foods and this type of vertical integration, and wonder how it might affect a business like yours. What types of things do you see your company needing to do in the future to evolve with it?
Well, that's a really good question, because we reacted to that nicely. We don't supply a lot of supermarkets with much. We're in the specialty foods business, so we'll pack some beans and grains and spices and things like that. But one of our keys in this particular area is I own my own farms. The purpose of having our own farms was to have experimental farms who could grow high-yielding crops per acre, because we have like a 110-day growing season if we don't get a hurricane here. So I have to find things that I can grow that I can sell for $3 or $4 a pound instead of 10 cents a pound. And I've served on many boards as far as cooperatives. You know, we came really close to creating this whole region is to grow berries like they do out in California, but the temperature moderated. It was for Häagen-Dazs. And so our farms have been experimental. As a result, we've grown some really cool produce. So you get Amazon buying Whole Foods, and they're a huge company, and all of a sudden they've got a warehouse that's not big enough. They can't handle 100 cases of French long beans. Or we've been doing is organizing the farms in New England to grow the varietal crops that they may not have slotting in their warehouse for, and be able to manage that in order to help farms survive. My cliche has always been, you know, if we don't have farms, we have nothing to eat. The old school was always buy it as cheap as you can and sell it as cheap as you can. And I grew up protecting the farmers with a good plan so they could always get a maximum yield in what they're trying to do, and they can stay alive. And I was very involved in organizing the California Organic Movement, the organic movement across America, the rare fruit movement in Florida, and just getting people to grow these things, knowing that they had a customer for them, and knowing that we weren't going to beat them down because they overproduced. And we've had that crop plan for years. We meet all winter with farmers, and they grow all summer for us in the regions. We're the guys with the unusual things for the markets, and for the consumer, keep reading about it. You know, everything that you're eating in those restaurants came from somewhere, and somehow we can connect.
Over lunch, I told you that I'm a bit of a foodie, and we walked through the store, and that was like a kid being taken to Disneyland and then taken out in 5 minutes. So I'm headed down there again to do some shopping after the interview. Your company, Sid Wainer & Son, sources some of the ingredients on the Food Network show Chopped. How did that relationship come about?
Well, it started just because we had great product and they were looking for unusual things. And we supply the whole U.S. We run trucks in about 11 states now, and we sell the best restaurants. I've been sourcing blessing and greetings, and through these crop plans that we've done with farms and through relationships that I built with suppliers who make wonderful products all over the world or produce great cheeses, we've just connected in the food network. They want all those unusual items because we sell cities where there's 46 restaurants, and we'll sell 43 of them. And I have chefs talking to chefs because all my salespeople are chefs. So they're planning all these menus, and we can diversify through all these varieties so everybody can be just a little bit different. And that's what cooking's all about, is to just give it your own little slant. No different than acting.
Shows like Chopped or Iron Chef or Anthony Bourdain glamorize the notion of being a chef, whereas 10 or 20 years ago, I don't think that was a profession that was necessarily looked at as being an artist, which it is. What are some of the hot food trends that you're seeing right now?
You know, people are traveling more. I'm traveling more. I've been all over the world. I've been to cooking classes in many places. I've met a lot of chefs. We've just connected with so many great chefs through our distribution network and through the stories that have been written about the company and the quality of the ingredients that we demand. Our suppliers all over the world know that we really want the best, and if they don't have the best, don't bother calling us. And, you know, that's been our standard, the best product for the best chefs in the country. And chefs are challenged because they're always trying to outdo each other, so they come to us to figure out what we can give them to help them outdo. So, and then now you can go online and you can read about pretty much anything you want to cook with for an ingredient, and then it all turns into fun when you get in the kitchen.
Are there any specialty foods that there's been a demand for but you haven't found a way to import?
The FDA does get involved in restrictions. When we had a hard time politically with France, all the cheese that was at the airport never got here. Sometimes you see duties on products. We're about to go through a 25% duty on truffles and some other things that are going to be coming from Europe. So it will slow down the usage, especially if people are trying to run to a budget, because not everybody can get $30 or $40 or $50 for a plate. The other side is, you know, the home cooking's come back. I mean, there's a lot of things that have no chicken lala from Nichols College, but, you know, oh God, I remember that stuff. A lot's come back to just good home, healthy cooking, healthy ingredients with lots of nutritional information. And God, everybody knows everything about nutrition and gluten-free. And they even talk about it. I was in Sicily last week and they were talking about if you use really good durum wheat, you don't have to worry about blah, blah, blah. So it has a lot to do with the ingredients that you're cooking.
We mentioned Anthony Bourdain before over lunch, whose show I greatly enjoyed watching. I think travel and cooking are something that his show sort of brought to the forefront. You must travel a lot in order to make relationships with produce and ingredient suppliers. And now that you've stepped back enough to actually go on more of a food experience travels, what are some of the favorite places that your travels have taken you?
Well, I haven't eaten crickets in Vietnam, but I did go to Vietnam. and friends of mine actually just came back from Cambodia, which was a very interesting story. My favorite food in the world is Italy. They're just family people. They're so passionate. They make great wine. They love ingredients. They cook what's seasonal from down the street or from their backyard. One of our best experiences was traveling in Japan. We ate actually at the Sashimi Master's restaurant in northern Japan, and he had a fish tank filled with blowfish. We ate that, and then I came back, and I forgot which James Bond movie came out, but they tried to get him to eat the blowfish to kill him, blah, blah, blah. So
there are only certain amount of chefs, right, that can actually even legally prepare that dish.
Right. You know, I spent a lot of time with Hardy DeSoto, God rest his soul, my roommate from college, and just eating some good homemade cheese in an arepa on the mountainside in Venezuela, and climbing on a truck that had probably 5,000 overripe mangoes leaking on the street, and you're eating a mango and you're wearing it, and you're really getting into the jungle and wondering, my God, this experience, someday will I be able to share that with my customers? And now you and I were talking about how you zoom into this farm where something's growing, and it's all happening now. All that knowledge, all that information of the source, you know, people don't appreciate that everything comes from a farm or from the ocean or from a field, and how it ends up in your plate. And then you talked about farm to table. I was very involved in that movement when it started. I was involved with Women Chefs and Restaurateurs when it started. I was involved in a lot of those organizations. But you go into a farm to table restaurant, there might be a chance where what's on your plate came from 9 different countries.
Wow. It really is mind-boggling. Our average listener might be hosting a dinner party, may make the trip out to New Bedford and visit Sid Wehner and Son to walk through the retail store. What kind of tips can you give listeners in terms of the types of things that they're putting on their table? What are the best cheeses for a cheese plate?
Well, I mean, cheeses are from all over the world now. Actually, an American cheese just won best cheese in the world for the first time ever, blue cheese. American cheese producers have come a long way, especially with blues and goats. To me, the hard cheeses and some of the soft, ripened goat's cheeses, I mean, it's like drinking great French wine. Europe just does a really good job. Some of the regulations that we have actually control some of the flavors of what we do. So, you know, you might go to Europe and taste something. It's like, boy, I can't, you know, a good San Marzano tomato. I can't get something like that. And the truth is that sometimes regulations overdo it. But with the holidays coming, you want to look at great charcuterie, great cheese. We're in winter summer white truffles now, which start in October. And that's a really fun story if you ever want to go to Alba, Italy, to the truffle festival of the world.
What's that like?
Oh, it's just crazy. I mean, I can just stories of being with my suppliers and being in the woods and hunting truffles and finding them and then going, making a great dinner. And they take out a knife and start cutting up, put ocean salt on the truffles. And
wow.
Yeah, you know, I got a lot of truffle stories to share with you, but it's truffle season now. You're in the fall. So, you know, you can cook with pumpkin seed oil and fresh chestnuts and fresh nuts and in good jams. Quince this time of year is really good to play with. And what you want to do is do a decorative family table and cook what your family loves to eat. And I guess if we went down in the outlet, I'd be pulling out cheese and charcuterie and figuring out a good vegetable dish to do with. Or if it was 2 months ago, we'd be eating great tomatoes with a really nice organic truffle salt. So you just play with the seasons, because the seasons are what makes food very interesting.
So if you had to pick a cheese plate with three different cheeses, what would be on that plate?
We have a Kilkern Estate cheddar from Somerset, England. I judged the British cheese competition this year. To me, that cheddar is just, it's got nice crystal flakes in it. It's absolutely spectacular. So I'd go with a crystal cheddar. Friends of mine in Lyon make a triple creme truffle cheese. I named it after my wife, Marion. It's got a row of truffles right in the center of this cream that just oozes out of the cheese. And I love Roquefort. So Roquefort, or if you want a good hard cheese, we have a Basque extraordinaire from the Basque region, which won best cheese in the world.
Wow.
Yeah, so
that's downstairs.
Yeah, we've got, and then there's. I was the first one to do when we lost Hardy. I went to Italy and stayed on a villa. Hardy, my roommate from Nichols, and I ended up making lunch for his whole family as a memorial.
Wow.
And I went to a market and I found this amazing prosciutto, which I now import. So the Tuscan prosciutto is like, it's like eating butter. It's delicious.
Oh boy! Wow. Recently, Jim Jackson, who graduated Nichols in 1969, he owns a company called Royal Bluff Orchards, and he came to campus. So he's actually trying to find two or three Nichols students that he wants to do an internship at his orchards in Washington State. And he wants to integrate the internship so they not only study marketing and in the business side of things, and they'll do projects for the orchard that way, but he wants them out in the orchards, making sure that they see every aspect of the business, from the growing to the picking. So that's an exciting thing, and that's something students are really embracing. Jim sends our office fresh apples through the holidays, and these are just the best tasting apples I've ever eaten. Can you give us some tips on choosing the fresh and the best tasting produce?
If you're buying commercial produce, you want to buy the brands that are familiar to you, because they really know what they're doing. They know how to control the temperatures, and they get at you at peak fresh, which is key. We work with some farms who actually grow fruit like they grow grapes in Europe, where they put it on dwarf stock facing the sun. They handpick everything. They never have to climb a ladder to get it. So, you know, it's like you just want to buy things that you want to go to a market that, you know, you either want to go to a farm stand locally because you want to support all your local farms, because without them, we're all out of business. Or you want to buy organics if you can afford it, because there's less chemical use and they're usually handled and treated differently.
So I could talk food with you all day. What do you want to pass along to the next generation who's just starting their climb up the ladder? I know you kind of went into a few things before, but if you had to boil it down to like three things, what would your advice to this generation who's trying to get where you are, what would your advice be?
Don't be afraid to work. Start at the ground floor and work your way up. Find something that you're very passionate about, because if you're not passionate about it, you're never going to succeed at it. Always make it your fault. Never blame the other guy. And be open-minded. Take every opportunity you can to explore the world, to see what's out there, so your eyes are wide open.
Great. Henry, I want to let you know that this has been a real pleasure having you on as a guest today. Thank you for taking the time to share your stories and your experiences and your knowledge with us.
Well, thank you for coming.
Welcome to the pen, the herd taking the court. We going for a win, we going for a win.